and with somebody who was born.
We left off in these editions on page 136, which is the end of Ma'ama Rishon, the end of the first essay. And it's number Kuf Tesvav, 115. It's about halfway through 115. In these paragraphs, it's paragraph number 4. It starts with Hayyudim Haheim.
Okay.
Again, if you have this edition, it's easier to find it. Page 136, the bottom paragraph, regarding these savory afterlife rewards. Hayyudim, those things which are promised. Kuf Tesvav, 115, about halfway through. Again, it's the fourth paragraph. About halfway through. Yeah, no, but about halfway through the Kuf Tesvav, that number. Hayyudim Ahem. We're back talking to Olam Haba. I mean, that's what we left off with last time. So that's always a good thing to pick up, with a little discussion of Olam Haba. And again, just to reiterate, we kind of left off in the middle of things. The King of the Kesars had said to the Chavir, to the Rav, when I contrast Judaism with Christianity and Islam, it seems to me like that Judaism's rewards pale in comparison to those of Christianity and Islam. Christianity and Islam have these very broad, very positive descriptions of what the afterlife is all about, in Islam in particular, with all of the physical pleasures which are supposed to accompany the afterlife. And Judaism, I open up the Chumash and I read about, if we do the mitzvahs, we get rain, rain, it's very nice, but, it seems to pale in comparison to the eternal bliss which is being promised by those other religions. So one point which the Chavir, the Rav, had made up till now is that the truth is the promises of the Torah are much more meaningful than the promises made by Islam and Christianity, because the promises of the Torah ultimately are all about the sense of closeness that we get to God, and that we can already experience somewhat in this world. In other words, the focus on the rewards of this world in the Chumash are because we experience some of God's closeness as a reward in this world. So that's just a little taste of the eternal closeness we'll have in Olam Haba. But we don't believe, as we quoted from the Rambam. The Rambam writes about those foolish Ishmaelites who believe that there's actually going to be a very tangible physical reward in the next world. We believe in closeness to God. That's what it's going to be all about, and that's going to be the eternal bliss. So that's the first idea which he developed at length. And now he comes with a second idea, which is, Vayyudim Ahem Asher Arvu Lecha. By the way, all of those promises which were so attractive to you, which, Christianity and Islam promise, Kvar Kodmu Chachomenu L'Saper Gan Eden V'Gehenem. Let's be honest. If you look in the writings of our Chachamim, in the Gemara and the Midrashim and the like, they described heaven and hell. It's not like the Christians or the Muslims came up with this idea on their own. They more or less took it from us. Up till now we've been talking about the promises in the Chumash and the Tanakh, which, you're right, don't really focus on the next world, and are much more this worldly. But you should know, we believe it's going to be a lichta gegan eden also. And in fact, our Chachamim, if you look at the Midrashim, they describe at length the exact concept of what Gan Eden and Gehenna are all about. If you look in Chazal, they actually describe the measurements, the length and the width of what Gehenna and Gan Eden are all about. They describe the pleasant aspects of Gan Eden and the torturous aspects of Gehenna. In other words, we've got it all in our literature also. In fact, you look in our literature, we have even more extensive descriptions of Gan Eden and Gehenna than they have in among the other nations. So in other words, your premise is flawed. Up until now, says the Rav, I've been working with your flawed premise, which is that Judaism only talks about the rewards of this world, not the rewards of the next world. That's the Tanakh that is true. But if you look at Chazal, there's plenty of description of what the next world is going to be about. V'dibarti imecho ad ato al mashemo shebo min bikro b'divri hanavim. Up until now, I've just been discussing the things that are in Tanakh, in the words of the Nevi'im, the words of the prophets. Kilo niskar bohem yehudei ha'olam haba harbe bebeir. Right? Because you point out correctly that if you look in the Tanakh does not spend a lot of time talking about the details of Olam Haba. That is correct, and I explained why that's so. But, you know, it's not to say that we don't believe in Olam Haba. Kashinizka harbe b'divri achachamim. The rabbis and the midrashim and the talmudim and the like talk about it at length. V'anesu, and everything that they have to say is true. So in other words, when all said and done, you know, you can you have this world or the next. You know, the Tanakh talks about the promises of this world. You know, the closeness to God that we experience already in this world, and all those nice things in Gehenna, and you know, not so much Gehenna, but all those nice things in Gan Eden, and the tortures of Gehenna. You know, we have plenty of, you know, what to say on that topic also. Ki b'divrei hanevuah, one thing which the Nevi'im do stress. In other words, we've said that the Tanakh and the Nevi'im tend to stress the rewards of this world, you know, and not so much the world to come. That's true. But there is one otherworldly thing which the Nevi'im do talk about. So in other words, you shouldn't think, as, by the way, you know, some secular scholars will tell you nowadays, you shouldn't think that the rabbis just came and made up this whole idea of Gehenna and Gan Eden, and that the Tanakh, you know, didn't address those issues at all. The Tanakh doesn't talk about, you know, it at length, but one thing which is clear in Tanakh is Shiyashuv ha'ofer shebeguf ha'adam el ha'aretz, that the physical aspects of man return to dust after 120 years, but v'toshuv ha'ruach el ha'elokim asher nesana, but the spirit, the neshama, is eternal and goes back to God. The immortality of the soul not only is a basic belief, says the Kuzari, but it is mentioned in Tanakh if you know how to look. Right? Now, he's stressing this because apparently at his time, as well as in our own time, there were those, again, nowadays it's, you know, secular biblical critics or whatnot, you know, but probably there were the equivalent back then as well. There were those who claim that the whole concept, the whole notion of the immortality of the soul was something which is not to be found in Tanakh, and the rabbis came along and they made that up later on. Right? I mean, in particular, we know that this goes back to the time of Chazal, because Chazal say that the Tzdukim, one of the heresies that the Sadducees put forward, was they denied the notion of Schar Va'onesh, they denied the notion of Olam Haba, and basically denied the notion of the immortality of the soul. Right? So, clearly the Kuzari is interested, as he wrote at the very beginning of the Kuzari, not just in responding to the Christians and the Muslims and the philosophers, but he also wants to respond to Jewish heretics who have the wrong idea about what it is that Judaism teaches. So you should know, this concept that the soul is eternal is to be found in Tanakh, he says. And where is it in Tanakh? Okay, it's very nice to say it's found in Tanakh, but again, if you go through the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, you're not going to find an obvious place where it talks about the notion that the soul is eternal. So he comes and says, no, if you know how to look, it's there. So first of all, the very phraseology that he uses, v'toshuv ha'ruach elohim asher nesana, the spirit goes back to God who gave it to him. If you look in the note, in 188, if you have the note, see Kohelis 12:7, v'ha'ruach toshuv elohim asher nesana is based on a pasuk in Kohelis. Right, so right off the back, right, it's footnote 188. If you don't have this edition, you're not going to have footnote 188. But take my word for it; it's there. So that the very choice of that phrase, which is a biblical phrase, is proof of his, you know, concept that the Tanakh itself speaks about the immortality of the soul. If you look in the words of the Nevi'im, first of all, you'll see Tchiyas HaMesim La'osid. You'll see explicitly the concept of Tchiyas HaMesim, the resurrection of the dead. Right? Those are based on Psukim in Daniel, right? Where in Sefer Daniel, at the very end, it says, V'rabim yesheni admas kodesh yakutsu, right? That many of those who sleep in the earth at the end of days are going to wake up. Right? So, I mean, the simple interpretation of that is talking about Tchiyas HaMesim. And then the Psukim in Yeshaya, Kutsav Yeranu Shochnei Ofer, right, which talks about how there's going to come a time where those people who lie in the earth are going to wake up and sing praises to God. Again, the simple interpretation of that pasuk in Yeshaya is also talking about Tchiyas HaMeisim. Now, Tchiyas HaMeisim would seem to only be possible, or at least probable, if there's a concept of the immortality of the soul. Because otherwise, what are you sticking back into the body? Right? If the body and the soul both disappear after the person dies, so then what exactly is animating the Tchiyas HaMeisim? I mean, it's not... You know, you could answer that question. You could say, well, you know, the same Ribbono Shel Olam who recreates the body, clearly the body has to come back together. So the same Ribbono Shel Olam recreates the body can recreate the soul. All right, but, you know, certainly the notion of Tchiyas HaMeisim would seem to fit more intuitively with the notion that the neshama is eternal. And then, you know, the eternal neshama is restored into the recreated body in order to bring about Tchiyas HaMeisim. So that's what number one. Ushlichas Novi. There's a fascinating article by Arya Kaplan, Zichrono Livracha, wrote a number of years ago, where he describes how one could imagine science getting to the point where science, with divine help, would be able to create Tchiyas HaMeisim. His point was not to exclude God from the process, because obviously, you know, in the end of the day, the Ribbono Shel Olam has to put the neshama back into the person. But to show how the idea of Tchiyas HaMeisim is not as far-fetched as we sometimes may think it is, and he starts describing, he was a physicist, he was very well-versed in the in contemporary science. He starts describing in physical terms how one could imagine the way science is going. Science getting to a point where actually through DNA and the like, you know, the human body could be recreated. I put that out there for anyone who has a better understanding than DNA, of DNA than I do, which is very, very limited. It's certainly an interesting idea. Al Kopanim, Ushlichas Novi, Shmo Eliyahu, Kvar Shulach Bezman Ha'over, Ulekocho Ho Elokim, Kasher Lukach Zuloso, Shehulo Toam Ta'am Miso. And one of the things he says, which is also explicit in Tanakh, is the notion that Eliyahu HaNovi did not die. Right there, the Tanakh says in Melachim he went up in a fiery storm up to heaven, and the pasuk in Malachi says that when Moshiach comes, he's going to be preceded by Eliyahu HaNavi. He now nochi shaleach lochem es Eliyahu HaNavi lifnei bo yom Hashem agadol v'hanora. So in other words, obviously, if Eliyahu HaNavi is going to be sent back at the time of Moshiach, it means he's there somewhere, you know, waiting to be sent on this mission. And our rabbis tell us that it wasn't simply Eliyahu who went up to heaven alive. There are others who didn't taste the taste of death. I mean, most obviously Chanoch, who's described in the Chumash, Vayishalei Chanoch es ha'elokim ve'enenu, ki lokachu so'elokim. Chanoch walked with God, and he wasn't because God took him. So, again, you know, the simple explanation as to what that means is that something happened to Chanoch, something along the lines as that which happened to Eliyahu, that God took him up to heaven while he was alive. So again, the very fact that Tanakh can discuss such notions implies that there's a concept of the immortality of the soul, because, I mean, after all, if a person's body could be immortal in certain cases, it certainly makes... I mean, where did God take him? He took him off to some place where immortal beings reside. So that place must be a chamber where the immortal souls reside, because otherwise, where is Eliyahu now? You know, where is Chanoch now? The fact that the Tanakh can talk in terms of Eliyahu and Chanoch going to somewhere while they're still alive means that there is such a place out there, such a holding pen, I mean, for lack of a better term, where the neshamas are immortal and where they are to be found. V'yesh b'torah tfilas misha hisnabe beruach ha'elokim shispalel al atzmo shiyomus mos yesharim uti achariso ka'acharis b'nei Yisrael. Additionally, another proof that the Tanakh believes in this notion of the immortality of the soul, we find that there's a certain prophet, Bilam HaRasha, who says, tomos nafshi mos yesharim, I wish that I should die the death of the righteous, and my end should be like the end of the righteous people. Right? That's one of the the klalos that turned into brachos, you know, the curses that turned into blessings as Bilam looks out over the Jewish people. So I ask you, basically says the Rav, if everybody dies and just disappears, so then what exactly is the meaning of Bilam davening, I want to die the death of the righteous? You know, if the death of the righteous or the death of the evildoers is all the same, you know, you vanish into thin air, basically the body rots and, you know, the soul disappears. If that's what happens to everybody, as Kohelis writes, you know, in rejecting this view, Mikra echad lakulam, la'adam la'behema, you know, there's men, animals, you know, people, animals, they all basically end up in the same situation. So then what was Bilam davening for? I want my end, I want my death to be like that of the righteous. That only has meaning if there's a concept of the immortality of the soul, writes the Kuzari. I'll give you another proof from the Tanakh. Ukvar shoel echad mehamalachim novi meis, v'hisnabi lo b'chomashi yavo alav kasher hoyo misnabi lo b'chayof. We know that there's a story about one of the kings who calls up, who conjures up a dead prophet, and the dead prophet appears to him and gives him an accurate prophecy as to what's going to happen to him, as if the prophet was still alive. The reference, of course, is to Sefer Shmuel, the end of Shmuel Aleph, where Shaul HaMelech, knowing that he's going to come to a big battle against the Plishtim, goes to the Balas Ov of Ein Dor, right? He goes to the the sorceress, you know, of Ein Dor. She conjures up the Navi Shmuel, who appears, and the Navi Shmuel comes, and the Navi Shmuel at that time is already dead, right? The soul of the Navi Shmuel, the neshama of the Navi Shmuel, is conjured up and speaks to to Shaul HaMelech and says, "Tomorrow you and your sons are going to be here with me, you know, on the other side." And indeed, that's what happens. Shaul and his sons go out to fight against the Plishtim, and they're all killed in battle, right? So that very story, says the Kuzari, only makes sense if the soul is immortal. Mm-hmm. Because if Shmuel died and then, poof, you know, vanished into thin air, there was nothing left of Shmuel afterwards, what was she conjuring up? So you'll tell me, okay, but you're not supposed to do that. Right? Now, there's this explicit prohibition in the Torah against a Baal Ov Yidoni, right? Because you're not supposed to conjure up, Dori Shalom Esim, you're not supposed to conjure up the dead and have them communicate with people. So the Kuzari addresses that. V'im hoya ma'isa ha-melechahu asur b'Torah seinu. It's true that what Shaul did is prohibited according to the Torah. Rav Salam Hadrishal Hamesim, right? In other words, you're not supposed to go and consult with the dead. Okay, so he did wrong. I mean, we're not addressing the propriety of what he did, but Lamaisa, the fact that he went and said, I need to conjure up Shmuel so that I can find out what's going to happen. And what's more, the fact that Shmuel actually gets conjured up and tells them what happens, the whole story only makes sense if they believed in the immortality of the soul. Because otherwise, what would you go and ask? How would you ask him? He's gone. Right? So okay, you're not supposed to ask him. But the very fact that Shaul HaMelech felt it would be effective to ask him, to conjure up Shmuel, and to ask his opinion as to what was going to happen, that only makes sense if they believed in the immortality of the soul. V'alkein hayushalim hamesim, and that's why they consulted, you know, with the dead, because they believed that the dead were still there on some level. It's interesting to know there's a very famous machlokes hamifarshim with regard to the Balas Ov of Ein Dor, whether it was real, or whether it was a fake out. In other words, did she really succeed in conjuring up Shmuel? Or she just, you know, she was Henrietta Houdini, you know, she was very, talented, right? You know, she was able to use sleight of hand to create the impression that she was conjuring up the dead. I mean, basically, there's a big machlokas, the Rambam and the Ramban, and then, you know, other Mephoshim take sides on this issue. Does magic actually work? The Rambam was a rationalist. Mm-hmm. He held that even though the Torah prohibits magic, doesn't mean that magic works. Basically, the Torah is telling you, don't do those silly, stupid things which people pretend are, you know, magical in nature. There's no such thing as sorcery. There's no such thing as being able to conjure up the dead. Nah, none of that stuff works. We don't believe in that. But you're not supposed to go through the actions as if, you know, they actually work. That's the Rambam's position. The Ramban very famously argues, he says, no. Magic works. Sorcery works. The Chartumim in Mitzrayim, they really did it. They weren't fake. They weren't faking. You know, it's not like they were very good at card tricks, you know, and stuff like that. No, right. They were the real thing. They were able to do it. Right. It's a Kala Chatumah. You know, Narvas, the Torah says that, you know, we're not supposed to do that stuff. But it does work. It's not that we're not supposed to do it because it's silly. We're not supposed to do it because it's evil. But it's actually, you know, it is effective.
It exists.
Does exist. So that's an old Machlokas HaRishonim, right? And it trickles down to what happened at Ein Dor also. Again, according to the Rambam, she couldn't have actually succeeded in conjuring up Shmuel because that's impossible. You can't do that, right? The Ramban disagrees. The Ramban says, no, she had the power to conjure up Shmuel, and indeed she really did conjure up Shmuel. Just the Torah says, you're not supposed to do those kind of things. These powers, which are out there and which are accessible, are nonetheless prohibited. Well, the Rambam didn't do that. You know, the Gemara talks about Rava, that the Amora Rava, the Gemara says, used to fashion. Yeah, it wasn't the Rambam. No, it wasn't the Rambam. The Gemara says that Rava, the Amora Rava, used to conjure up such a thing.
So
I assume the Rambam would probably read that Gemara non-literally. I mean, again, I don't know exactly how he reads it, but, you know, he couldn't. I would imagine the Rambam probably has a different interpretation of that Gemara, you know, that's much more quote unquote rationalistic, you know, that whatever he did was in line with the science the way we understand it. Because again, according to the Rambam, these type of magical things are simply not possible. You know. Yeah, no, so the Ramban wouldn't have a problem with that at all. The Ramban would say, yeah, okay. Why is it not Kishav? Okay, so that's a different... Right, but it's clearly possible. Right, it's clearly possible. Okay. Now, it's interesting to note, the Khuzari skirts the line. You know, he doesn't, if you read him carefully, I don't think he's taking a position in this machlokas between the Rambam and the Ramban. In other words, did she actually conjure up Shmuel or not? So, again, when he starts off, right, he describes how one of the kings asked after a certain dead prophet, right, which seems to indicate the immortality of the soul. But the ultimate proof that he brings for the fact that the soul is immortal is the fact that people believed enough to want to go to people to conjure up these spirits. He doesn't actually take a position on the issue of whether it's actually possible to conjure up these spirits, but the fact that people believed that you could conjure up the spirits means that they must have believed that the spirits were eternal. So obviously, if they believed the neshama is eternal, where'd they get that from? So that part, you know, must come from, you know, the Torah and the hashkafos that were revealed to them at Har Sinai. So in other words, he steers clear of taking a position on the smachlokas as to whether it was actually effective or not, but he does, you know, the very fact that people believe that it was possible, whether it's possible or not, the fact that they believe that it's possible, show that they believed in the concept of the immortality of the soul. Just an interesting thing to add to this, which he doesn't mention, Rav Shamsher Rafael Hirsch, who was also struggling with the critics and the, you know, the skeptics of his day, who also claimed, yeah, you know, the Torah doesn't believe in the immortality of the soul. That was a later rabbinic notion that they grafted on to the Torah. So Rav Hirsch pointed to a phrase which occurs over and over again throughout Tanakh, and he says it's just such a simple phrase, but it only makes sense if you believe in the immortality of the soul. We had it a few weeks ago. Yaakov Avinu dies, right? Vayigva, he passes away. Vayeosef el amov, and he was gathered to his people. So he asked Rav Hirsch, what does that mean, he was gathered to his people? Doesn't mean he was buried. Because take the example of Yaakov Avinu, right? I mean, they embalmed him and they kept him in Egypt for 40 days before they took the body up to Eretz Israel to bury in the Ma'ariv Samach Pela. So when it says that he expired Vayeosef el Amov, and right away he was gathered into his people. Says Rav Hirsch, the only explanation you can give to that phrase is that his neshama joined the neshamos of his ancestors. Because otherwise, what does it mean? What does it mean, Vayeosef el Amov? Right? It's a beautifully, you know, the best insights are always the simplest insights, right? You know, you read it so many times in the Chumash, Vayeosef el Amov, he was gathered unto his people, you know, whatever it says in the fancy English translation. Right? But that, it says, Rav Hirsch, the concept, what does that mean? The concept only makes sense if you believe in the immortality of the soul. Otherwise, the phrase just doesn't make sense as a phrase. Right? Doesn't mean he was buried, because it's clear from the story of Yaakov, he's not buried right then. Right? When he died, he was gathered into his people. It's a beautiful proof, you know, and it shows that the Tanakh as well, you know, already in Chumash, if you know how to read it properly, you know, you can see the concept that Hishoaru Sanefesh, you know, that the soul is immortal. Not only that, Upsichas Tfiloseinu, Shiyodin Oso, Hanoshim Vaktanim, Kol Shekinach Chachom, with my apologies to everyone here, the opening lines of our davening, says the Rav to the Kuzari, that everybody knows, the women, the children, and certainly the rabbis. What's that? Anoshim v'aktanim? You know v'aktanim? Okay, must have been censored, right? But right. The very beginning of our tefillah, first thing in the day, that everybody knows, every Jew knows this. I mean, the point he's bringing out is that this is such a fundamental idea that we express it first thing in the morning. Is Elokai neshama shenosata bi tahora. The soul you put in me is pure. You created it, you formed it, you blew it into me, you keep it in my midst. There's going to come a time that you're going to take it away from me. Eventually you're going to give it back to me, i.e. the soul is immortal, because otherwise it couldn't be taken away and then put back in. By the way, his version of the bracha was a little bit different, right? As long as the neshama is in my midst, I thank you, O Hashem, my God, that you are the master of everything which is created. Blessed is God who restores souls to dead bodies. So this very tefillah, which we say every morning, and by the way, we say Moda Ani first thing every morning. If you look in the Gemara makes it clear that the original practice, going back to the time of Chazal, was to say Elokai Neshama when you woke up in the morning. Moda Ani is a substitute for Elokai Neshama. Elokai Neshama was the original thing. So he says the first thing, that's what he says, Psichas Tfiloseinu, the very first bracha we say first thing in the morning, talks about the immortality of the soul. That's how much we hold of this concept. It's not just incidental, it's fundamental to everything we do. The notion that the soul is immortal. Right? In teaching Geirim, I always try to make sure that, you know, again, you can't learn everything, right? I mean, it takes a lifetime to learn everything. But at least one bracha that they should be saying before they convert is Elokai Neshama. Right? Because again, as the Kuzari apparently, the Rav HaChaver, you know, the Rav here in the story, apparently thought that this was an important, the one tefillah that he teaches to the king of the Kaisers is Elokai Neshama. Right? And as he sees that, and we'll see in a few moments, the king of the Kaisers is going to say, okay, that's a good idea, I'm going to convert. Right? So in other words, you know, one of the tefillos, one of the concepts, which apparently was so important to convey prior to his actual conversion, was this tefillah of Elokai Neshama that expresses the idea of the immortality of the soul. So we believe in the immortality of the soul. V'gan Eden Atzma, shehirbu b'nei Adam l'zachro, let's be honest, everything that everybody talks about, the notion of heaven, which again the Muslims talk about, the Christians talk about, where do you think they got it from? They got it from us, they got it from the Torah. I mean, and the very phrase Gan Eden, I mean, Gan Eden itself, we know Gan Eden comes from the Garden of Eden, you know, from not the restaurant, you know, the place which is, you know, described right in the beginning of Sefer Bereishis. Lo'lachu osokim la'Torah, comes from the Torah. Himadrega shehuchna la'Adam. And this was the ultimate level of spirituality which was prepared for Adam HaRishon. V'lulei shechotoya omeid bo la'netzach. And had he not sinned, he would have been there forever. Right, so in other words, the very term Gan Eden is borrowed from the Torah. V'chein Gehenem, u'makom yadua karav liyushalayim. And the word Gehenem is also, it's a place name. You can go today and see Gehenem in Yerushalayim. right? It was Gay Ben Hinnom. It was the valley of Ben Hinnom. Right? It's a certain place that's close to Yerushalayim. Gai Shein Ho'esh Nichbeis Mimenu, a place where the fire is constantly burning. Because Ha'yusarfim Bo'atzmos HaTumah V'Anavelos Yishar HaTumos. They went to this valley and they used to burn constantly all of the items which became Tomei outside of Yerushalayim, which became impure outside of Yerushalayim. And that's why the term Gehenim was coined for purgatory. Right? Because in real life, Gehenim was a place where the fires were constantly burning in order to burn all of these impure objects. So by way of analogy, I mean, it's obviously a big difference, but by way of analogy, the place, the celestial place where the fires are constantly burning is Gehenim. Right? So that's Yivais. That's where they got the term from. V'hamilo ivris morkevis. It's a composite word in Hebrew, Gay Ben Hinnom, the valley of Ben Hinnom, where things took place. Omar Akuzari. So after this whole description of what Judaism has to offer in terms of Olam Haba, the King of the Kaiser says, Im kein ein chidush achare toraschem, el chelkius midivri gan eden v'gehenem, right? The truth is, the other religions have nothing to add to your Torah when it comes to Gan Eden and Gehenim. Right? They just add some extra descriptions, perhaps, which don't appear in our Torah, in our words of Chazal. But on a fundamental level, the premise I started off with is an incorrect premise. Right? Really, the rewards that Judaism has to offer is everything that Islam and Christianity have to offer, right? All of the promises of Gan Eden and Gehenim, right? Plus, the closeness to God, which has been developed, plus the immortality of the soul. In other words, they didn't really add anything. I was attracted to those other religions because they seem to have a more, robust concept, a richer concept of what Gan Eden is all about. I see it's not true. Gam zein enu chadosh. And even so, says back the Chavir in Kuf Yud Zayin, the truth is, even the details are nothing new. Ki achachamim hirbu bozeh me'od. Ash lo tishma menu me'uma shlo timsenu l'chachamim kasher tivakshenu. Our chachamim had so much to say about, the next world, that there's nothing true which you can find in the other religions, which isn't already said and spelled out in the words of our Chachamim. Right? So in other words, they have nothing over us when it comes to the ideas of Schar V'Onesh. So that apparently clinches it. Because as we start the Maimar Sheni, the second essay, V'achari chen, hoyo me'inyin akuzari mashu noda b'sifrei kuzar. What happened afterwards is to the King of the Kaisers is what's recorded in the chronicles of the Kaisers. Migaloso sod chalomo lusar sivao. Because first, what happened? First, he went and revealed his dream to his general, to the general of his armies. In other words, this recurring dream that he had, where the Malach came to him and said, your intentions are good, but your actions are not up to snuff. The recurring dream which he had, right? So the dream kept coming back to him, and it told him that he should go find the path to the proper actions, the actions that are acceptable before God. Bahare Har Son, in the Warsan mountains out in the periphery of the Khazar's kingdom. Those are real mountains, I think, if you look. It gives you a map. Maybe in the back. On page 32, if you have it. In Khazaria, in the... if you see, right by the Caspian Sea, in the southeastern corner, it points you to the Warsan Mountains. It's good to know in case you happen to be lost in Khazaria. So this way, what is this today? It's over Turkey. This is probably modern Georgia? Yeah, the Bukharians, right? I mean, it's that area where they come from. Right? You see, the Byzantine Empire, that's Turkey. This is the... These are all the stands. You know, all those stands. You know, Uzbekistan, you know, all those places. Right? The places on the risk game, basically. You know, that's they're all over here. So that's the Warsan Mountains. So he went out to the Warsan Mountains with his general. V'lechtom shneyam. Hamelech v'sar tzeva'o. The two of them, the king and his general, went together. El haharim ahem asher b'midbar al hayom. Those mountains which are out in the desert by the sea, the Caspian Sea, again as you can see. V'heach higiu abalaila lo saham ha'ora. And at night, they came to a certain cave out in the Warsan Mountains. Shehayu shovsim l'sham anoshim ha'yehudim b'chol Shabbos. Every Shabbos, there were Jews who went out to this cave to keep Shabbos there. He discusses a little bit in footnote number 2, that why were they keeping Shabbos out in the mountains, you know, in a cave? I mean, what's going on over here? So either it was a time of persecution, right? And we know that even going back to the times of Chazal, right, when the Jews wanted to keep Shabbos secretly, they would go into caves so they wouldn't be bothered by anyone else. Or, no, they just didn't want to be bothered by anyone else. They just wanted to keep Shabbos and, you know, not have to sit and talk and gossip and do whatever everybody else was doing on Shabbos. This way they went out into the desert, they were able to clear their thoughts and really observe Shabbos like a retreat, you know, in a very, very spiritual kind of setting. So either way, there were Jews out there in the mountains, in the caves, you know, who were keeping Shabbos. Oh, right. So so the king and his general go out there to this cave. Veheach niru aleim, and they appeared to these Jews out there in the cave. Venichnasu b'torasam, they entered into their religion. They were megaya. Venimolu b'me'ora hahi, and they were circumcised out there in that cave. I guess among the Jews who were out there was somebody who knew how to do a bris milah. Right? So the king and his general came back to their country, and in their hearts they kept the Jewish religion. But originally they kept their faith a secret. Because again, even though they were the two most important people in the country, you know, they weren't sure how the country people were going to react. And, you know, they wanted to keep it a secret initially. Until they figured out a way to gradually reveal some of their secret to some of their inner circle, until they were able to expose their conscience, and they were able to strengthen themselves over the rest of the Khazars. They brought them into the religion of the Jews. And now they brought chachamim, they brought rabbis and svarim from all different Jewish lands, and they started learning Torah altogether.
So what about the fact that we don't really take gerim when we, you know, we expect them to know everything before they're misgayer, like...
Right, so we certainly don't expect them to know everything before they're misgayer,
at least accept certain...
Yeah. No, so apparently that's what happened. I mean, the way the process is described, at least by the Gemara, is somebody comes to be Megaya, and you teach him Mixas Kalos and Mixas Chamuros, you teach him a smattering of some of the harder laws and some of the not-so-hard laws. You try to impress upon him that the Jewish people are persecuted, and, you know, by joining us, he's joining a persecuted people. And if he accepts all of that, so, again, according to the letter of the law in the Gemara, in the Shulchan Aruch, you give him a bris milah, you bring him to mikvah, and he converts. Right? Now, nowadays, it's not as simple as that, because people have many, many motivations
agendas.
For seeking out Judaism and agendas, and again, we want to make sure that they're actually sincere and that they know what they're doing and whatnot, but apparently, you know, the king had demonstrated his sincerity. You know, I mean, there had to be something in it that was sincere for him to embrace Judaism. I mean, it's not that he got anything out of it in a physical or financial sense. It was clearly, you know, l'shem shamayim. I mean, otherwise, why would he do it? Why would he keep it secret? You know, there was certainly nothing for him to gain, in doing that. But essentially, what's described over here is the conversion process. He and his chief of staff, his general, go out, they convert, and then they come back, And gradually, they bring the rest of the Khazars along to their way of thinking until finally, you know, there's this massive influx of Rabbanim and Svarim, which are brought into the country in order to teach the entire population Torah. I mean, the truth is, if you think about it, and again, as we discussed at the very beginning, this is rooted in historical facts. I mean, we know we have letters from the kingdom of the Khazars that describe this whole story in its essence. Again, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi may have, you know, embellished some of the details of the conversation. I mean, the conversation is from Yehuda Halevi, but the basic facts that the king and his entire country converted, that's true. And it's astounding. I mean, if you stop and think about it, I mean, it's amazing, right? I mean, the entire country, basically, you know, they convert to Judaism, and all of a sudden they're opening up yeshivas and bringing in Rabbanim, you know, to teach the entire country Torah.
And yet the Torah doesn't encourage people to
do this.
Right, it doesn't encourage, but Lamaisa, they were sincere, and they wanted. They wanted, they were looking for it.
This is really a true story.
This is a true story, right.
You know, I thought this would be at the end of the book, the conversion. And I'm just wondering, what is the rest of that?
Right, right. Now that we know that the butler did it, you know, so what's the rest of it about? Right, no, it's interesting because, you know, obviously Rabbi Yehuda, again, the conversation presumably was made up by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. I mean, I don't know how much he really had in terms of the you know, the conversations back and forth. And again, clearly, it's probably fair to say Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was a much greater chacham than, you know, whoever they ended up speaking to in real life, you know, when the story took place. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was one of the, you know, the great Rishonim. So, you know, I'd much rather hear what he has to say than what was, you know, perhaps actually said. So he chose to have it chose to make the story this way, to have the king of the Khazars convert early on. Mm-hmm. Right? It could be that what he was concerned about was, you know, the rabbis say that, generally speaking, you know, unless somebody is studying for conversion, you know, we try to keep the study and teaching of Torah within the Jewish fold. So to have a whole book where he would go through Torah in depth, which is really what he does over here, and then have the conversion take place only at the end, perhaps he was uncomfortable with doing it that way. So in other words, the first essay is all about giving you a taste, enough of a taste to know that you're interested. And then, you know, they decide to convert. And now the rest of the book, I mean, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, the rest of the essays in the book are conversations between a Rav and a Jew. Because the king of the Khazars is now Jewish. You know, and he's now able to appreciate, you know, in greater depth, you know, all of the details which the Rav is going to go into. I mean, if he would only convert at the end, this would be a very long curriculum, you know, very massive curriculum that this king would have to study. So that's what happened. And by the way, the chronicles tell the story of how these Khazars were very successful, you know, at war, right? They were able to overcome their enemies and conquer various countries. They were able to take a lot of spoils. They were able to make armies that numbered hundreds and thousands of soldiers. And all of that material success took place hand in hand with a love for Torah and a yearning for the Beis HaMikdash to be rebuilt. And get this, Ad Shekimu Tavnis HaMishkan Asher Asa Moshe. They actually erected in their kingdom a replica of the Mishkan which Moshe made. Right? I mean, you can go today to the old city of Yerushalayim, you can see Machon HaMikdash. They had Machon HaMikdash back in the kingdom of the Khazars. At that point, by the way, presumably is historically true, because, you know, why would Rabbi Yehuda Halevi just throw that in? I mean, it doesn't, it only serves to enhance the story if it's true. They showed tremendous respect to Jewish people. And they would accept brachos from them, as is recorded in all of the Sfarim of the Khazars. As the king now began to learn the Torah and the Nevi'im, the Tanakh, so he took this Rav, who had just been a guest lecturer, so to speak, he now hired him. He's now the official chief rabbi of the kingdom of the Caesars, right? V'haya sholoso she'elos ivrios, and all of his Jewish questions he would address to the rabbi, right? Utchilas mashesholoso, the first issue which he brought up with him was al hashemos vehamidos. He asked him about the different names and attributes hamyuchasos el abara yisparach, which the Torah uses to describe Hakadosh Baruch Hu. And the fact that some of these terms seem to describe God in human terms, and how can that be, that you know that some of these terms describe God in physical or human terms? After all, it's not reasonable to assume that God has a body. And what's more, the Torah itself describes God as invisible and, you know, lacking a body. So how are we to explain all of the places in Tanakh which describe God in what seem to be human or physical terms on the surface? Now, by the way, you appreciate a change in the type of discussion. I mean, even here, right at the beginning of the second essay, right? The first essay, the king is asking questions about Judaism, kind of in the abstract. What is it that you believe in, right? Here, he's asking questions on the Chumash, right? There was a Rav who taught at YU for many years, Rav Moshe Bezdin, Olav Hashalom, who ran the beginners program. It was called the JSS program at YU. So he famously coined the expression that, you know, here, you know, when we teach the students who are coming from public school and never had any exposure to Yiddishkeit, we teach it, not about it. Right? In other words, you could go to a program where they talk about Yiddishkeit, they talk about Judaism, they talk about, you know, what it means, and, you know, they talk about philosophical things. And again, you know, to an extent, obviously, all of that is good. But ultimately, his philosophy was, the only way to really understand Judaism is to open up a book, a text, to open up a Chumash, to open up a Navi, to open up a Mishnayis, to open up a Mishneh Berurah, you know, to open up a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. In other words, you have to learn it. You know, if you want to understand Judaism, you have to learn Torah, not just Torah in the broad abstract sense, right? But you have to learn the Psukim, right? In Avinik, right? So in other words, that was the phrase that he coined, which to this day they still use around the yeshiva. We learn it, you know, not about it, right?
Very good.
So you know, it's interesting the kind of question. The questions in the first essay were about it, which of course is what you'd expect. I mean,
he doesn't know it.
He never saw it. You know, he doesn't have a book. You know, I mean. So, but here, all of a sudden, so he starts going through Tanakh and he says, wait, I don't understand. How is this word used? How is that word used? How does this make sense? How does that make sense? You know, he's beginning to read inside, and by reading inside, the sophistication of the questions and the sophistication of the discussion is going to reach a new level. So, just to go back to the question, so why does he convert at the beginning of essay 2 as opposed to doing it at the end? L'chara, until he converts, they can never really have the kind of discussions on this level, the kind of it as opposed to about it discussions, which are going to be the rest of the sefer.
I guess they won't discuss too much anymore the comparison of the religions anymore. That isn't necessary. He's found it.
Right. It will come back to that here and there. No, but you're right. I mean, certainly as a major focus, he's moved away from that. You know, that was in the about it stage. Right now, we're learning it. Right, and the truth is, I mean, if you look at Kiruv programs to this day, the ones that are good, you know, hopefully move from it, from about it to it at some point during the process. I mean, the ones that unfortunately are not as successful as they should be, you know, tend to stay in the about it, you know, stage of things. You know, everything is, you know. Yeah, philosophy, right, you know. Again, philosophy is not a bad thing, but I mean, when you talk, you know, when you spend 5 years talking about, you know, in very vague terms what we believe in, but you can't read a pasuk, so that's not a good chinuch, that's not a good form of education. You know, ultimately the way to understand Yiddishkeit, this is, we're the people of the book, you know, I mean, you gotta open up the book, and you know, take a look and see what it says. Otherwise, you know, you're just talking in abstract terms forever and ever and ever, right? And again, you know, it's oftentimes these Kiruv programs can only talk about it in the beginning, because if you talk it right from the beginning, nobody's interested, right? But I mean, at a certain point, there has to be this transition from about it to it, if what's going to be learned is going to be real, is going to be meaningful. Otherwise, it's just, you know, pie in the sky, you know, and discussions forever. Okay, Bez Hashem, so we can pat ourselves on the back, so to speak. So this is, we've just finished 20% of the Sefer HaKuzari, one out of the five essays which comprise the Sefer. It's probably deserving of a siyum of sorts. What we'll do next week, Be'ezus Hashem, when we pick up, we'll start with the actual about, the actual it. I'll get it straight one of these days. We'll start with the actual it, you know, try as the Rav tries to explain to this new Jew, you know, why is it that the Torah oftentimes uses you know, seemingly human terms to describe the Ribbono Shel Olam, when we know that that can't be right, so, you know, in a literal sense. So I mean, what does the Torah have in mind with that? So we'll pick up with that Be'ezus Hashem in that beginning of that second essay, God willing, next time.
On that note, previous generations, were there, is it known if there were